Michael Cathcart, you're very welcome to this special edition of Books and Arts Daily. Today, an entire show dedicated to tears, the works of art and literature that bring us to tears, art made from tears. It's the third and final show in our series on blood, sweat and tears. Tears is the name of the song you're hearing now, the classic by guitarist Django Reinhardt and Stefan Grappelli sliding around on that violin. It's a wonderful sound, isn't it? Today you'll hear how that much-loved Australian actor William McInnes cries on stage, and you'll meet visual artist Sue Saxon, who makes artwork from real tears, which she collects in little glass jars. So this morning, tears of rage, tears of joy, tears of sorrow. Your response, Mr. Ray Charles?
I guess I'll cry in my tears.
Ray Charles with Drown in My Own Tears. Well, first, let's look at tears and tragedy in literature. Joining me to mine the rich vein of tragic plays and teary books is Michael Williams, who is director of the Wheeler Centre for Books, Writing and Ideas in Melbourne. And Michael will be with us for the whole show. Thank you for coming into Books and Arts Daily.
Absolute pleasure. Is there anything nicer than a good cry?
Nothing nicer than a good cry. Are you a cry yourself?
Yes, I am. I love a good blub. I think there is nothing more cathartic than that thing of, and we do go to the arts for exactly that, you know. Tears in life are generally attached to you feeling a bit fragile, you're not doing that well. Whereas if you can get that out of your system, if you can get that kind of feeling of catharsis that comes from a good old-fashioned sob out of something that's removed from your own life, then so much the better.
That's weird, isn't it? So we actually not, tears are not that welcome in the real world.
I think the idea of catharsis is useful. I mean, tears presumably come at the end of something. They come at the end of a period of high pressure, anxiety, sadness, whatever it is. And so the moment when you're able to have a cry, to my mind, is the moment of release. It's the moment where you're no longer saying, I'm going to just manfully struggle through this. It's the moment where you go, no, that's it. I've got a parking fine and I'm parked outside the Queen Victoria Market and that's it. I'm just going to have a little cry behind the wheel of the car before I get on with it.
Actually, seriously, if you think about a funeral, if you're giving a talk at a funeral and you start to cry, a lot of people feel upset that they've started to cry. But actually, it's so real. And the tears, I mean, it sounds callous to say you use them, but if you're there talking about someone you love and you're crying, it actually makes the thing more real.
I think in that context, and in lots of contexts, there's that thing where you will find yourself smiling as tears come to your eyes, where it is the sense of relief, the sense of, you know, the tears are a product of grief, they're a product of hurt, they're a product of, you know, these deep and difficult emotions. But the moment that the tears come is the moment where you can go, hurrah. I've found a way to identify this and be true to it.
So what are the books that make you cry, Michael?
There are a few of them, and it always takes me by surprise. There are the classical books that you read that where you cry because of that thing of familiarity. You know the moment's going to come. You know when you're reading Of Mice and Men, when Lenny and George's relationship has to come to its inevitable kind of conclusion, that it's familiar, you know it's coming, you know that it's inevitable, and the tears well up as a kind of consequence of anticipation. Which is amazing.
You're a dad. You've got two little boys. What about kids? Books for younger kids?
Yeah, I have to say, tears before bedtime is a very familiar concept to any parent. But children's books are quite good at kind of twisting that knife. I find ones that are around. I'm shocked since I've had kids at how open I am to moments of rank sentimentality. Like, it's very upsetting to me. I used to be a person of judgment, very carefully, you know, not moved by cheap sentimentality.
Sophisticated chap.
A work cover ad can tip me over the edge at the moment. I don't know. It could be sleep deprivation, or it could just be that thing of empathy. There's the wonderful Australian children's author Bob Graham has a book called Let's Get a Pup, about a family that go to get a dog from an animal shelter. And it's a very simple story. They know what they want. They want a cheeky little puppy that does this, this, and this, and plays with the family and smells nice and everything. And they get there and they find the dog that they want. But over one cage over, standing there is this big, fat, ugly dog that no one wants, that stands there kind of forlornly smiling at them and hangs its head when they walk away. Every time I read that book, and anyone with small children knows you read a book on a fairly rapid repeat, I tear up at that page. I can't help it.
Yeah.
They take the big dog home. Right. Spoiler alert, but it's all okay in the end.
And what do the kids say? They say, don't cry, Daddy, or it'll be all right.
They say, why is it sad? Well, because the dog's been left behind. And then why are you crying again now that they've taken the dog home? And so, well, I'm crying happy tears now. It's a complex world.
Happy tears. So you're introducing the concept of dichotomy to the kids early on.
It's very important, the word.
It is, indeed. Now, suppose we go to the other end. You think about a Shakespearean tragedy. I don't remember ever crying in a Shakespeare play.
I think when a production's a good production, it's often the stuff that's left of centre that gets you. You know, Lear has some extraordinary moments. In Hamlet, I'm more likely to be moved by Horatio than I am by Hamlet himself. There is something about, you know, the loyal friend, or the, you know, those kind of peripheral things can be done with great delicacy and great, you know.
But even at the end, where they're all dying, you know, and let flights of angels, whatever, was it Carrie, take thee to thy rest, or whatever the line is. I mean, I'm not crying. I mean, my heart's in my mouth.
No, everyone Hamlet's ever met is dead, except for boring old Fortinbras, who comes kind of marching in with pomp and ceremony.
Takes the throne.
It is strange. There is something about those kind of tragedies that's archetypal. We recognise it, we can see it for tragedy, but the kind of human scale of it is a bit lost on us because it's so familiar. Antony and Cleopatra, to me, has some extraordinary and moving moments, but I've never seen a production of it that would take me anywhere near tears. On the page, perhaps, because on the page, as a reader, I take myself halfway towards Shakespeare and we meet somewhere in the middle and we have a little chat and I see what it is that he's up to, and it either hits me where it hurts or it doesn't. A play, there are all kinds of people in between me and Shakespeare, actors and things. It's much more difficult.
Right. What about nonfiction? Do you ever cry at nonfiction?
I think there's something in, we're very desensitized when we watch the news and when we hear these kind of tragic and terrible news stories. And my sense is there's something about scale, where we can insert ourselves into a story, where it's possible to empathize with the people in it, we're far more likely to be moved to tears. And in nonfiction writing, you know, a book like Philip Gurevich's And Then Tomorrow We'll Be Killed With Our Families, about Rwanda, is extraordinary. And it's extraordinary because Gurevich, as a journalist, goes into the individual stories and really brings alive the human impact of a large-scale massacre. And so moments like that definitely can move me to tears.
Mm. This is Books and Arts Daily on RN. I'm talking to Michael Williams in a show that's devoted entirely to tears. Well, let's move from the couch where that tragic novel is making you cry and move up on stage for tragedy on a much grander scale. Follia nel mondo ciò che non è piacer. Gariamo fugace rubido il gaudio d'amore. Un fior che non si muore e più si può cader. Gariamo circita. Well, as we all know, some of the greatest tragedies are operas, and the catalogue of operas is full of stories of despair and love gone wrong and young death and betrayal. One of the reasons that opera fans love opera so much is that the stories are so often intense and so much larger than life. Australian soprano Emma Matthews joins me now. We've just been listening to her there singing from La Traviata. That was the Opera Australia production on Sydney Harbour. Good morning.
Good morning.
Were you wiping away a tear?
No, I hate listening to myself.
Do you? We love it. The rest of us are happy. You can talk among yourself while the rest of us.
But it was a very emotional experience, especially the final act, performing that outside in the open air, and the emotion, everything was heightened so much more because it was on such a grand scale. It was fantastic to do.
So it ends up with Violetta dying of tuberculosis.
Mm. But I just, given the extraordinary physicality of performing opera, you know, how much are you caught up in the kind of technical, okay, can I hit that note, can I, you know, and how much are you able to give over to the narrative and the kind of tragedy of it?
By the time you're performing the role, you shouldn't be thinking, how am I going to get to that note? That's the technical preparation you do before you get to that point. So for me, if that's happening, then something's not working and you've got to go and fix it. And it's very much about the emotion that you're delivering and making the sound as beautiful and as expressive as possible.
Mm. So there are sort of there are kind of technical devices that opera singers use, don't they? There's a kind of throb you can put into your voice. I mean, tenors are famous for it, but so are sopranos.
Absolutely. There's a whole thing.
Right.
There's a lot of expression that you can add to a sound. It depends on the period of music that you're singing. If you look at the early music, you had the repeated notes on the same pitch, which were indicative of a sob. In bel canto, it's very much beautiful singing, and it's there in the music, and you sway through it. In the romantic period, you have Puccini, which is much more. You need a lot more warmth and depth of colours in your sound. I would never sing Puccini. I don't have that range of colour in my voice. But it's generally written, which is fabulous.
Let's talk about some of the operas, because there are so many that end, with sadness. I mean, I've just seen Rigoletto.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't seen it before. The Australian Opera's recent production of Rigoletto. And just tell us what happens at the end of that, because it's terribly sad.
Well, it's heartbreaking because Gilda goes to save the Duke, the man that she's in love with, and he's there cheating on her, and she realises that her father's planning to kill him, so she disguises herself as a man and knocks on the door, and she gets killed in his place and put in the bag, and her father opens this sack and discovers that it's his daughter, not the Duke, and she says goodbye, but, you know, it's okay, Dad, I'm going to where my mum is. Mm. I can see my mum, she's calling me, the angel's calling me, and it's just so, and once again, you know, Verdi does this subtle sort of ripple in the orchestra, and she just sings this fine line over the top, and it's quite beautiful.
And it's horribly unfair, because Rigoletto is this hunchback who's been kicked around by everybody, and he hasn't been entirely nice himself, but in the end, he's holding the corpse of his daughter. He tried to get the Duke killed, but everything's gone terribly wrong. And because of the scheme that he set in motion, his own beloved daughter, the only thing in the world he loves, the only person in the world he loves, is dead.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking. His final cry at the end is just, that's devastating.
It is interesting to me, though, that synopsis. If you applied it to a piece of drama that didn't have opera attached to it, you'd think it was completely over the top. And the idea that you might be moved by it seems to me more distant. You know, this is kind of got elements of farce, and it's got elements of hero, the incomprehension
and melodrama.
And so it kind of defeats that kind of emotional response. And yet you bring in the musical component, and then suddenly you're much more forgiving of the melodrama, because the music and the singing takes you up to that next level emotionally.
Absolutely, I agree. I think Rigoletto is probably one of the better stories around too, of opera stories, but it is very much that writing, and Verdi just knows how to pull at the heartstrings.
But it is the music. The music gives a kind of seriousness and weight to a story that without the music would be melodramatic. And it's also true of the acting style. It's really struck me going to quite a lot of opera in the last 18 months where how often you're looking at opera singers doing a style of acting that would be dismissed as melodramatic on the stage, on the main stage, because you've got to stand there for, you know, 90 seconds, 2 minutes, while someone is singing, I hate you, I hate you, I absolutely hate you, get out of my life, I hate you more than this. Whereas in the play, you just say, I hate you. So meanwhile, while someone's singing at you, I hate you, I have to stand there with, you know, one hand to my forehead and the other, you know, fending you off in a kind of dramatic pose, which I've got to hold for ages. Do you know that sort of acting?
Yeah, I think that's changing a bit now. I think we're expected to do a lot more than that now.
Still a bit of it around, though, because you've still got to hold a pose for quite a long time while somebody sings the same thing over and over and over.
Certainly, if you're talking about something like The Ring, that would happen because there's a lot of numbers that go for an hour.
And you've got an hour and a half of someone saying, open the door, open the door,
exactly,
open the door.
Exactly.
It's kind of hard to act your way around that, I would have thought.
It's so strange to be talking to you, Emma, because I've just seen you in The Turk in Italy by Rossini, which is a completely silly story. It's totally joyful, totally fun, not a tear to be shed, even when terrible things are happening. Everybody's just laughing their way through it.
But that's right.
What tragic role is your favourite?
Probably Lucia de Lammermoor, Lucia. I think playing her was really devastating to me personally as well as vocally. It was just wonderful.
Well, I don't want to put you in pain, but let's hear a little of you performing Lucia de Lammermoor. La vita, emotion here feels very powerful. I have no idea what's happening in the story at this point. I don't know the opera, but I feel as though something really big and deep is happening.
She really wants that door open. That's what I can tell.
Come on, focus. Try to be a bit serious.
She's been forced into a marriage and she obviously loves somebody else and she's murdered her husband on their wedding bed, and she's appeared down into the guests of the wedding with a bloodstained nightie and the dagger, and she's gone. She's completely gone. That's amazing you've got that. That's from a rehearsal.
Is that like a bootleg recording? Is that something we shouldn't have?
Ooh.
It sounded okay. We all thought it was great.
I would have believed it was the final thing. That question of rehearsing it, though, and doing it night on night, does it, for you, who clearly has such kind of empathy for your character there and compassion, and you're so moved by her story, does it heighten it? I mean, are you more emotional the third time you've done it or the first time?
I think it's learning to control the emotion that I feel as I sing that music. Certainly, as I'm learning to do it, going through the rehearsal process, I can go too far and it really affects me. And I think having a normal life to go home to really helps to switch off. But certainly in a role like this, before I'd start that mad scene, I'd get myself into a very dark place and think of everything possibly painful that could have happened to me and go there and, feel that physical abuse, feel the pain and just clock into it so that you're in that mindset. And you cannot think about the music. You cannot think about what you're doing production-wise. You just have to be. And that was really hard. I know at the end of that scene, I'd have to walk off like a broken child. And because in this production, it was insinuated that she was raped on the wedding bed, there was also that physical pain. So it was really quite traumatic.
This is Books and Arts Daily on RN, a whole show devoted to tears. And my guests in the studio this morning are Emma Matthews, the opera singer, and Michael Williams, who runs the Wheeler Centre. Now, a listener's tweeted in, I sobbed while reading Paul Hamm's traumatically vivid description of the A-bomb and its impact on children in his book Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So that's an example of non-fiction moving you to tears. And Paul's tweeted, reading William Horwood's Dunction Wood made me cry, as well as A Ring of Bright Water. That's the autobiographical book by Gavin Maxwell. Are there books that have made you cry, Emma?
Yes. I like particular writers. I like Jodi Picoult and Anita Shreve and writers like that. So I'm not into the... I mean, I do love the classics as well. But I'm more of a... It takes me a long time to read a book, I must say, these days. I wish I had more time to do it.
But both those writers traffic a bit in plots and characters that deliberately court tears. I think that part of what they're writing for is that, you know, that emotional response. It's about setting up a world where you're going to be moved.
Well, let's stay with tears on stage. William McInnes is one of Australia's best-known actors. He was the cop who cried in Blue Heelers. He cried in Sea Change, and most recently on that ABC television drama Time of Our Lives. He shed tears on stage too, and he's had sad things happen to him in real life, most poignantly the death of his very talented wife, Sarah Watt. So are there tricks that actors trade in, actors use to cry on cue? Suzanne Donisthorpe speaks to William McInnes about crying on stage.
William McInnes, you've done a lot of acting in various parts. Some of them have required you to cry. How hard is it to cry?
On camera, it's quite hard to cry because it's a stop-start process. You can work yourself up. I mean, I know terrific actors can go there, but more often than not, it's how it comes out of the hand. You can sort of get carried away with a sense of emotion. But because it's a repetitive process, it's pretty draining. So after a while, I think most actors try to approximate the emotion, and then they get a bit of help from the makeup department, which is basically a glass cylinder with a bit of menthol in it, and they blow it into your eyes. And that irritates the eyes, and then tears come. You can't abuse the process, though, because the more you do it, the more irritated you get. So it can unlock the effluent gates, and sometimes you don't know what's going to come out of your nose. And I did it a couple of times once, and it was like a bad case of nasal diarrhea. And they had to suspend the shoot so I could get made up again. But they blow it into your eyes, and you get a picturesque tear. And sometimes you just get irritated eyes. More often than not, I think most people just sort of burrow their heads and make sniffling sounds, like some student trying to get out of a sort of end-of-term exam or something like that. But on stage, you can, it's more Machiavellian, a bit more tricksy.
Because, well, there's no makeup artists that can come running in, can they?
Well, I've acted with people who've had a eucalyptus and they put it on their eyes, and that has a similar effect. But you can half blind yourself. You went from acting with, you know, Henry IV to Helen Keller because the guy was bouncing around all over the shop. You stare at lights. That's an old one. You stare at lights. That's good on television. I used to do that on Blue Heelers. Occasionally I had to cry. And you just stare at an eye and maybe poke yourself and you get a couple of tears.
Like when you're acting, do you feel sad, or is it really just a kind of physiological or makeup-induced device?
You couldn't always feel sad. You can't always go there because it's draining. And then that way it's not acting. But you can get into an emotional state. It's like if you give a big speech, you get pretty excited and you get into it and you get a bit pumped. But you can on occasion be in the zone and you can go there emotionally. And that's when acting is really draining. But more often than not, it's a trick, if you like. But it's how it comes out of the hand. But it is a lot of fun, the tricks people use. There's that great story about Laurence Olivier having a pair of grapes in his fingers when he was playing Oedipus. And then, he squashed them into his eyes when he had to sort of poke out his eyes, and tears ran down. But one of the pips one night got into his eye and he couldn't see for a week. So it's, even the great ones can come undone by these sleights of hand.
What about trying to get the audience to cry? I mean, as an actor, you're taking people into a place where they want to empathise with your character. So you're crying through some sort of artifice, and as you say, it's because it's too difficult to go there. But you're also trying to get that emotion in the audience. How do you do that?
It's a strange thing when you really feel someone being moved in a theatre. Because
can you feel that from on the stage? Can you feel the audience going with you?
I did a play in the late 90s called Pride and Prejudice, where I was one of the worst Mr. Darcy's ever. My mother came to see it and she said I was like a block of housing commission flats. it's what people bring to it. And there were occasions in that show, which I don't think was a great show. I mean, even had a crack, you know. But, I mean, you could have put a boiled cabbage on and it would have worked. It was immensely successful in Melbourne and at the STC and the MTC. But there were a couple of moments there I was completely befuddled by the effect it had on people. And it's not as if the people didn't know how it was going to end. There were times when people, you could hear them sniffling and in tears out there, wondering if everything was going to work out okay. I'm thinking, well, it's not a whodunit, you know. You know they get together. But, and it was as hopeless as I was quite intrigued by the reaction it had and elicited from people. And I think it's what people bring to the show. And, you know, a show like that really did sort of push all the buttons. But I have been in the theatre and been incredibly moved and teared up a couple of times watching other people act. And it's...
Do you find theatre more emotional than film in that respect? Do you find it's a more visceral feeling to be in the audience in theatre?
I don't know. I mean, I think as a performer who is in an audience and is moved, I find it more odd in the theatre. I thought, how do they make me feel that? And it's not every time, but I mean, I can blub at the drop of a hat when I'm watching something on TV. I mean, I think Les Mis is just one of the all-time worst, you know, mixed salads, that film. And it was, you know, it's crazily awful. But every time that girl, Anne Hathaway, dies, and I've had to watch it a couple of times, and I'm blubbing like a baby. I think, why am I crying? I mean, I could watch... I mean, I cry. I can. My kids just get upset the way I cry so often in front of the TV. I mean, I cried during a Murder, She Wrote. Now, who cries at that sort of shite? I'm like my parents.
What about ads? Kleenex ads are always designed to make you cry.
I can remember crying at an old telecom, I think. They used to do those long distance phone calls and phone home. Yeah. And I was at uni. I had the arse out of my trousers, and I had no money. And I was just sitting at this awful, you know, one of those awful rental houses, the shared houses that almost everyone who goes to university has to live through. And that ad came on, and I was just in tears.
And then you're tearing up now a little bit.
Oh, yeah. It was pretty
remembering funny. That ad.
It was a bit like a house out of Withnail and I. And this guy who we used to call Mal, because he was always so malnourished, that's his nickname, he said, come on, mate, we'll make a phone call. And he said it was the last of the old phone calls where you could actually hold the receiver upside down and yell into the earpiece and you could hear. But my father was in a bad mood, and he thought he had no idea who it was, and he'd tell me to go get buggered and stop plaguing me. It was me. So it turned out from something that was quite pathetic, we started laughing a lot.
Well, you've had sad times in your life too. I mean, that obviously must play on your mind sometimes. Do you take those kind of experiences into your performances?
No. I mean, you can, but again, I don't think it's deceitful in any way to use what happens in your life, but I can't admit to being a great actor. I'm just a guy who basically turns up, and if the menthol blower's on hand, I'll put my hand up for every time.
William McKinnis proving that big boys do cry, although sometimes with artificial assistance. He was speaking there to Suzanne Donisthorpe. And if you go to our website, there's a longer article, or there's an article based on that interview and a longer version of that interview for you to download. You're on RN. This is Books and Arts Daily. This is the final in our series on blood, sweat and tears today. We're talking about tears. Emma Matthews is with us. Are there tricks there that you recognise as an opera singer that you use to cry on stage?
Yes, I often do the staring into lights, especially if I have to enter crying. And I did a role a couple of years ago, Amina in La Sonnambula, and I had to have a sleepwalking scene, so I had to stare, and I had to enter staring and somehow still see the conductor. And as I stared, the tears, because I was staring into just sort of nothing, everything became a haze in front of me, and I had to walk, and the tears just started pouring down. It was very effective, but because I wasn't allowing myself to blink, it was mad, but that was probably my best crying that I've ever done on stage.
What about
stage?
The Laurence Olivier grape trick? I hadn't heard that one before.
That's fantastic.
But the pip, you'd have to
especially
make sure...
Especially if your eyes were coming out and you had to have that sort of gooey...
A bit of fleshiness.
Yes.
To play with, yeah. Yeah. What about this? I mean, that was a painful issue with William McKinnis because his wife died, and that question of whether you draw on personal sadness in order to, you know, cry, it's quite a moral issue for performers because... I don't know, it seems a kind of cheap thing to do.
I've often had directors say to me, you know, ask me very personal questions in the rehearsal room and, you know, have you lost somebody? Did you see them die? And you know, and one director actually asked me once if I'd ever been raped, you know, and I was quite horrified and shocked. And so I thought about, you know, that I do know of somebody close to me that was. So I imagined how she felt and what she went through and watching how she tried to recover from it all. And I use that in my interpretation at that point. But it's very hard to go to find that connection. But you do need to find a point to start from, and then you control it.
There is a question about using the person or the listener who texted in before with the memoir that made them cry. You know, writers come up against that all the time, is how much can they mine their own experience and their own family, the people they know. The comedic writer David Sedaris recently wrote a piece about his younger sister's suicide, and it was an incredibly moving, incredibly kind of... it moved me to tears. And yet he got quite a bit of flack for it, because there was a perception that the point of the piece was to move readers to tears. And so somehow that was cannibalising the experience.
Yeah, that he was exploiting his own personal tragedy.
Yeah.
I remember that. I mean, also you expect David Sedaris to amuse you most of the time.
I think that fine line actually is where you can be most moved, actually, where you expect to laugh and you end up crying, where you expect to cry and you end up laughing. Charles Dickens, who is very good at manipulating the emotions of his readers, the death of Little Nell, Oscar Wilde memorably said that you had to have a heart made of stone not to have a bit of a laugh when you read The Death of Little Nell.
This is Books and Arts Daily on RN. We're looking at Art Made of Tears. Michael Williams from the Wheeler Centre is with us in the studio, and also Emma Matthews, the opera singer. Let's look at another musical genre that has tragedy embedded in its very name, the blues. Well, it tries not to cry, cries as he tries, cries, oh Lord, I'm so tired of crying, and they all try, don't try, not don't worry. So one of Australia's leading blues mamas, Lil Fee. She's been singing the blues for nearly a quarter of a century, and that song's called Alzheimer's from her album Time and Love. Fee thinks that tears are a private matter and that performers need to contain their grief on stage, which is an interesting observation coming from a blues singer. On Skype, Fee tells Doug Spencer from Books and Arts that the heroine of Alzheimer's is her own mother. She died when Fee was only 26.
Her journey through Alzheimer's and our journey as a family through that Alzheimer's experience. So it was more dementia than Alzheimer's when I look back on it. It was a great learning. She was brave enough to be the sick one for us to learn what we learned through it. So, yeah, sometimes tears are necessary.
But you don't give in to tears. I mean, some people wallow in them, and sometimes wallowing in them might be a good thing. But correct me if I'm wrong, but I've seen you perform many times, and I think I've heard all of your available recordings, and that's something you resolutely refuse to do.
I think that tears are a private moment that don't need to be... You don't indulge them, I think. There have been moments of great tears, but they're a private thing for me. Like after the fires down in Victoria, that was a terrible experience, seeing all those people and those families. I started a really terrible choir so that people could get away from their tears. So there was a moment where I said, just come along and leave your sadness in the tea room with the tea and come in and have a laugh. And there was one lady who lost her everything. She lost her family. She lost all the children and friends and their animals and everything. And so she was weighed down by grief. And also she had to prove who she was so she could even get into a bank account. And she came in, she said, I can't sing. And I said, that's all right, don't sing. Just tick-tock like a clock. And I did this song, you gotta make some time. Keep a bit for me, I wanna make some time. Give it out for free, I wanna make some time. She just laughed the whole time, hysterically laughed. And I thought that was a much better solution for her than more tears.
There may have been some tears of laughter running down her face.
Oh, there was. There was. There was definitely tears of laughter that night from all of us. There are many different types of tears. There's tears of joy, there's tears of laughter, there's grief tears, there's holy tears, there's, you know, the shortest verse in the Bible, Jesus wept.
A lot of the songs that you sing are your own songs. Have you ever written any of those with tears running down your face as you were writing?
Probably more than one or two. I don't know if that any of them made it to an album.
Now, when you're on stage, I know from watching people performing on stage, when people lose it and start tearing up on stage, that can do unfortunate things to people's voices. Have you experienced that?
I have experienced that a couple of times. I actually remember mentioning to one of my friends who used to do it all the time, and she's a very passionate singer, a fantastic singer. And I remember saying to her early on in her career, darling, that audience is not your therapy. We don't want to see you hurt that much. And I think that there's a dangerous place or line there in using the time on stage as therapy when the singer is so emotionally involved in the song that they let it overtake them, or being able to contain that. It's a very fine line, but I think it's okay if it's just too much and it happens, but don't let it be the conqueror of the situation.
Any practical tips on how to contain the threat of unwelcome tears when you are performing?
Oh, breathing. Breathing works. Nice big deep breath every time. And don't look at the person that makes you want to cry. Or don't think of the trigger.
I know Dolly Parton succeeded in writing a song that did make you cry. Tell us about that.
Coat of Many Colours. Took me years to be able to sing that song without crying.
Mama sewed the rags together, so I never peace with love. She made my coat of many colours that I was so proud of.
And I often wonder if it's the actual frequency of her voice. I've got a Dolly Parton video here, and I watch it, and every time I watch it, I cry. You know, she sings from such a heartfelt place. Her songwriting is so down home and familiar to me, having grown up in caravan parks and housing commission sort of accommodation, coming from adverse place. She came from a very poor place as well. Financially poor, but emotionally rich. Rich in love and kindness.
Coat of Many Colours it's a poignant song, but it is ultimately a song of celebration. It's certainly not a whinging song. So what are the kind of tears that you're crying when you're hearing it?
Oh, just that mother trying to raise her child, and she's sewing such love and kindness into her child's clothing, but sewing it into her life and giving her such kindness and compassion. And I think as a young woman who's lost her mother early in her life, brings back those memories of that lovely, kind mother who loved you. I wrote a little song about a cardigan that my mother had that I ended up with, and I lost it at a festival. And that's, I think, the main song that I wrote crying, now I think about it. And I was just broken from losing this cardigan. Yeah, it was a real moment of sharing grief through a piece of clothing. And I've had people write me letters saying how that song touched them so deeply, and they've sent me cardigans in the mail, which I think is quite lovely. Bit weird, but it's nice, you know, that a song can bring out such emotion in someone. So that's my Coat of Many Colours, that song.
It was my mama's favourite cardigan before she went to the stars. I was given the old blue cardigan and I wore it with love in my heart.
Little Fee speaking there with RN's Doug Spencer via Skype, and you can find out more about her music and about her on our website. Michael Williams is with me from the Wheeler Centre, and Emma Matthews, who's the opera singer. Performance is not therapy. That's a good thing to remember. I mean, often I go to a show and I see a lot of actors exploring their psyche on stage, and I think, oh, I wish you'd explore that in the rehearsal room and not charge me for a ticket to watch you do it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but having it workshopped, we're very big on performative grief nowadays as a society, coming together and showing your tears to show that you're part of a kind of collective.
Yeah, are there songs that have made you cry?
Paul Kelly can often do it. How to Make Gravy, I struggled to listen to without crying. And the Weddings, Parties, Anything song, Father's Day, when Mick Thomas's voice, it's a triumphant song, it's a great rock ballad, but it hits me where it hurts every time.
You know
time.
What really gets me is Susan Boyle singing I've Dreamed a Dream on Britain's Got Talent.
Shiver Down the Spine and then Tears Welling Up.
I'm afraid it gets me every time. It often pops up on my sort of favourites, you know, when you're on YouTube and there she is, I think, oh, yeah, I'll listen to it again. And I always cry.
It is why those shows work. It's about finding that trigger where you just a few chords are enough to set you off.
It's certainly one of those songs, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Well, it's also the fact that, you know, it's her, this story of this, you know, this middle-aged woman who sort of waddles out and makes a bit of a prat of herself and then sings like an angel.
My father-in-law's totally in love with her.
Is that right?
Absolutely.
Well, let's move on because this is a good segue to Tears of Joy. Isabel and Rachel are a comedy duo whose show Edge won the award for best comedy at last year's Melbourne Fringe Festival. They're also prone to tears.
My name is Rachel Davis.
And I'm Isabel Angus.
And we're from a comedy duo called Isabel and Rachel.
I cry really easily from laughing, but not from sadness. So I have done it many times. And you as well.
Yeah. Oh, no, I cry easily from both, though.
Yes, she just cries easily.
We know something's going to work on stage when it does result in that uncontrollable laughing till you cry sort of thing, when we're both sort of doubled over in my bedroom, uncontrollably gasping for air. There's this thing that Isabel does which every single time she's done it, and I've seen it hundreds of times now, probably since about 2006, that never ever fails to make me collapse with laughter and cry with laughter. And we like to call it pillow head, and it is sort of as simple as it sounds, but there's something unexpectedly absurd and ridiculous about it. Isabel, would you like to tell us what pillow head is?
It's hard for me to say because I actually don't know what it looks like or what's going on because I have a pillow on my head. So I don't know. I don't know what's going on. I just put a pillow on my head and dance like Latin dancing with a pillow on my head.
Sort of as if she has maracas in her hands, but she doesn't. And instead of maracas, there's only a pillow on her head.
And there's lots of clapping and like hand twirling and I can't see where I'm going. I can't breathe. And I just don't really know what it looks like, but I think we know it's funny. And I'm laughing, but it's the whole thing is ridiculous.
And we try it with lots of different songs as well. And it does work with lots of songs, but I think we've recently found the one that it works best with. It's Let's Get Loud
by J-Lo. But I
said that. Well, Jennifer Lopez. She was known as Jennifer Lopez.
Now she's J-Lo. Yes. Jenny from the Block, actually. Here we go.
And when we put it on stage, it's incredible because audiences, for a split second, are just shocked and confused.
Like, and why is she, what?
Why is this happening? And then it's like when the doctor, like, hits your knee and your knee flips up, you can't control it. Mm. The audiences just can't help but laugh. I cannot keep a straight face when I'm on stage and Isabel has a pillow on her head. And we've tried it with other things. The interesting thing is it doesn't work with other objects. It's a pillow or nothing. Remember when you tried it with that big ball?
Yes, and we tried it with a box. And we tried putting, I think we tried putting a face on the pillow, like drawing a smiley face. It's minimalist. It's just got to be a white, preferably a white pillow.
And quite a firm one because it has to stand up very straight.
Yeah.
The only really stressful element of it is that Isabel can't see. Or breathe. But for me, I care more about the see thing because I'm watching her almost falling over. We work on lots of different stages, so she'll just come out and give it all she's got, and I'm sort of panicking that she's going to fall over and, like, trip off the stage. But it's never happened.
But at least my head would be padded.
You wouldn't break your fall.
Because there's a pillow on there.
Hence the name Pillow Head.
Comedy duo Isabel and Rachel and the object of their tears, Pillow Head. And you can find more about them on our website. On RN, this is Books and Arts Daily, the last of our series celebrating the art of blood, sweat and tears.
Painter Ian Fairweather built a raft from materials found on a Darwin beach.
He never actually said why he did it. It wasn't a very bright idea at all.
Then sailed to Timor.
It was absolutely insane. He nearly lost his life.
The journey that captures the imagination.
When they failed to locate his raft, Fairweather was reported lost at sea.
Fairweather's Raft, Poetica, Saturday at 3.
Now you say you're lonely. world, you can cry me a river. Cry me a river. I cried a river over you.
The sultry Julie London and Cry Me a River, the song she made famous back in 1955, a torch song about love gone wrong. Well, people have been shedding tears of love, of mourning, of joy since the dawn of humanity. Sue Saxon is a visual artist who's made a whole show based on tears and the emotional history that they bear. Back in 1998, she mounted a show called The Tears I Cried For You. It toured Australia as part of the Water Medicine Show, curated by Kevin Murray. And Sue joins us now from Sydney. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
This is a lovely word you've got to teach us, lacrimatory.
Lacrimatories. It comes from the lacrimal gland in the eye, which is the one that actually produces the tears. And so lacrimatories were the bottles that, or the vials that held, that collected the tears.
And they go right back to Roman times.
Well, they found evidence of them in Greek, Roman and Hebrew tombs, and they believe that they actually held the tears of relatives and friends of the deceased, or professional mourners who were employed to wail and express the emotion that the funeral motivated. And the tear bottles that I created with the help of Peter Minson, a glassmaker from Yass, was based on a beautiful Roman tear bottle that's in the Nicholson Museum at Sydney Uni. It was a blue glass bottle which was tear-shaped, and holding it was extraordinary.
You mean just holding it in your hand was extraordinary? What? How do you mean it was extraordinary?
Holding something that was so old, it was probably 2,500 years old, so it was something, the oldest thing I'd ever held.
Oh, I see, yeah.
But it was also quite a beautiful object, and to think that it had contained tears from such a long time ago was extraordinary too.
There's a reference to these little tear bottles in the Bible. Psalm 56 has David praying to God, saying, "Thou tellest my wanderings, put thou my tears in thy bottle. Are they not in thy book?"
Well, that it really concurs with the idea that they have found in Hebrew tombs as well. I like this idea of collecting tears, knowing that the whole project was quite paradoxical. Because when you cry, and you've gone through such a range of emotion in your show today, when you cry, it's generally, unless you're an actor or a performer, an involuntary action or an unconscious action, and often it's private unless you are a professional mourner. So the whole project itself was working with this paradox of the conscious and the unconscious and the private and the public.
So you persuaded various people to collect their tears and seal them in a little bottle.
I sent out 100 of these tear bottles of lacrimatories, and the ones that Peter Minson created for me were about 20 centimetres long and quite sensuous in shape, with a round base. And I asked each person, and these people were selected through friends and advice from different colleagues, to try and cover a range of sexual, political and cultural backgrounds. And I gave them each a small label to note the reason they cried and this element of their identity. So just a single facet of their identity.
So it's an extraordinary range of people. Just give us such a brief sense of the range of people from whom you collected tears.
Shall I read you some of the tears?
Yeah, just a few, just in 15, 20 seconds, no more than that.
Tears of sorrow at the suicide of a friend's teenage daughter. Tears shed by a widower. Tears shed by an Aboriginal woman while watching Oprah. Tears shed to win sympathy. Tears shed by a Muslim. Tears of bitter pride. Tears of deep sadness at the death of an uncle leaving a father the only witness to the family's life in Poland. Tears shed by an Israeli while listening to Tchaikovsky's Violin Concerto, which is meant to be the one piece of music that is irresistible. Mm. Tears shed by a Buddhist. Tears shed by a lesbian when Andy Sipowicz witnessed the murder of his wife Sylvia in a courtroom shooting on NYPD.
Well, Sue, it's a very beautiful list. It's a very human list, and it really, I don't know, it seems to unite the whole of humanity in a kind of river of tears collected in tiny glass jars. Sue, thank you for joining us. It's been lovely to talk to you.
My pleasure.
Sue Saxon is an artist and art educator, and she is the Caldor Public Arts Projects Manager of Education, Interpretation and Engagement. This is Books and Arts Daily, and we're exploring tears in art. Well, do you cry in movies? Do you find yourself trying to hide it, putting on the sunnies as you leave the cinema so that no one sees you howling? Producer Sarah Lestrange is on a mission to find out what makes RN presenters all teary in the movies.
Amanda Smith from Body Sphere. Tearjerkers, what makes you cry?
When I was really young, I wanted to be brave and not cry because I was a bit of a crybaby, and it was important to me to try to be brave. And I remember with my family going to see Born Free, the movie about the lions.
Born free as the wind blows.
And it was so affecting, and I so, so wanted to cry, but I so had to try and make myself not cry because I was a brave girl.
Alice Keith, The Live Set, Tearjerker Films. Do you cry when you go to the cinema?
I do, but I sometimes cry at things that, you know, probably aren't that sad. What was the last thing I cried at? Now I watched Dirty Dancing recently and I cried. It wasn't even a bit where you're supposed to cry. I think I was just embarrassed that I was watching it.
Jonathan Green, do you tear up in movies?
Yes, I do. I'm a blubber. I can't help myself. But it has to be, I don't know, something truly sad.
So, like, not a rom-com?
Rom-coms, no. I'm not a Bridget Jones blubber by any stretch of the imagination. Hugh Grant leaves me entirely untouched by deep feelings of hurt. But something, I mean, something that is tragic. Philomena gave me a bit of a nose tingle, I must say. I can't think of other particular examples, but it's that sort of Jude the Obscure, Jane Eyre sense of profound injustice.
Hi, Natasha Mitchell from Life Matters. I will admit that every movie is a potential tearjerker for me. I know that's a bit tragic, isn't it? I think it started with Storm Boy. That was the first movie my mother took me to as a child. Filmed in South Australia's beautiful Coorong. I was actually there near the mouth of the Murray River over summer this last year, and memories of Mr. Percival the Pelican came flooding right back to me. Emphasis on flooding, because when Mr. Percival dies in Storm Boy, when I was six, I was totally inconsolable.
Anita Barrow presenting First Bite. What are your favourite tearjerker movies?
Oh, am I going to admit something bad here? Every Christmas, my family sits down and watches Love Actually. Isn't that... that's actually worth crying about, really, isn't it? I cry because I first saw it just after September 11, and the first scene makes me cry, where they're at the airport and the voiceover comes on with that floppy-haired fellow who I can't stand usually.
Hugh Grant.
Hugh Grant, that's the one. Where he says, airports, we meet, nobody is unhappy. Usually they're greeting or they're sad because people are leaving. It's a place of deep human emotion. Makes me cry.
When the planes hit the Twin Towers, as far as I know, none of the phone calls from the people on board were messages of hate or revenge. They were all messages of love. If you look for it, I've got a sneaky feeling you'll find that love actually is all around.
Yes, what a weepy lot we are. Love Actually is one of mine too. Michael Williams, what makes you cry in the movies?
Toy Story 3 gets me every time, I'm going to be honest. But there is 2 minutes at the start of the Pixar movie Up where there's a little montage of the old man's life up until the point that starts the film. That 2 minutes on YouTube in the movie, I can watch that back to back and I will cry every time.
Yeah, the Toy Stories are great. Those little toys just trying to get back to where they belong. Emma Matthews?
Yeah, mine would be Beaches.
with the Did You Ever Know That You're My Hero, the amazing Bette Midler singing that. So the combination of the voice and that incredible story. I watched it recently with my kids and we were all a mess. And also Frozen. Just, I don't know why, but I just cry in Frozen. I just think it's beautiful.
It's funny how embarrassing it is. I cry at the end of Pretty Woman. I cry at the end of Mary Poppins when she goes.
My biggest problem is on a plane. I'll cry at any movie on a plane.
Any movie.
Any movie at all.
Hey. The saddest thing is we have to stop.
Oh. Tears before bedtime again.
Thank you so much for coming in. It's been a joy to have you here. Michael Williams, who runs the Wheeler Centre, and Emma Matthews, who's a marvellous opera singer. Thanks to all of you who joined in the conversation on Twitter and on website. Keep it going. Keep sobbing. We're a whole family of RN listeners united by tears. Thanks to the team. The executive producer is Rhiannon Brown. The producers, Sarah Lestrange, Kate Evans, Georgia Moody, Suzanne Donisthorpe, James Patterson, and Doug Spencer. Technical operators, you're all marvellous. John Jacobs is with us today. There's lots of art on RN over the weekend. Don't forget the music show with Andy Ford at 10 tomorrow. Weekend Arts with Melanie Tate. And, of course, Books Plus with Kate Evans on Sunday at 2. On RN, we're coming up to news time. Shed a tear. Until 11 o'clock, this is RN.
Coming up on The Final Cut, films about parents, kids and a sea of neuroses. The director of the new Romanian film Child's Pose speaks to me about how making a movie based on his own domineering mother was like therapy. The Broken Circle Breakdown is a story of childhood illness and also Flemish bluegrass hipster musician parents. And speaking of hipsters, Jon Favreau's Chef is a father-son road movie set in a food truck. That's The Final Cut with me, Jason DeRosso, online anytime at the RN website.